Today on the 21st Show, religious affiliation has been declining in America, but Christian voters are still a potent force and help return Donald Trump to the White House, where he says he will have their backs.
We will protect Christians in our schools, in our military, in our government, in our workplaces, hospitals, and in our public squares. And we will bring our country back together as one nation under God with liberty and justice for all.
How did we get here? What role has Christianity played in American history? And how did so many Christians come to embrace Donald Trump? My guest for the hour is Robert P. Jones, founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's written a series of books about the past, present, and future of white Christian America. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, it's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. President Donald Trump has long had a close relationship with white Christian America. Such voters were crucial to his narrow Electoral College victory in 2016, and last year, he knew how important their votes would be again.
You won't have to do it anymore. 4 more years, you know what? It'll be fixed. It'll be fine. You won't have to vote anymore, my beautiful Christians. I love you, Christians. I'm a Christian. I love you. Get out. You got to get out and vote. In 4 years, you don't have to vote again. We'll have it fixed so good you're not going to have to vote.
Now, in case you have any doubts about the depth of this relationship and the seeming belief among some Christians that Trump's essentially a prophet, here's the Reverend Franklin Graham at Trump's inauguration back in January.
Mr. President, the last 4 years, there are times I'm sure you thought it was pretty dark. But look what God has done. We praise him and give him glory.
Today's show is not going to be entirely about Donald Trump, or maybe even mostly about him. But because he is the endpoint for the American story so far, I will be returning to him throughout the hour. My guest today has made studying the intersection of history, religion, and politics his life's work. Robert P. Jones is the president and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's also the author of several books on these topics, including The End of White Christian America, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, and most recently, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. This is a conversation that first aired in February and was tied to a lecture Jones was going to at the Department of Religion at the University of Illinois. So because we're re-airing it, no phone calls throughout the hour today, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. All right, I want to begin by asking about your origin story. A nice Southern Baptist boy from Mississippi. What makes you want to grow up and start talking about things like white supremacy and the legacy of racism in America?
Well, right. So I was brought up, for the most part, in Jackson, Mississippi. I grew up as kind of a cradle Southern Baptist, and my family has been Southern Baptist since there were Southern Baptists in the U.S., and that is since 1845, when the Southern Baptists broke from their Northern Baptist brethren over the issue of slavery. And, you know, I actually, the opening words to my last book, White Too Long, were just kind of started with that fact that, you know, the denomination which I grew up was founded on the belief that enslaving others based on the color of their skin was compatible with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that was the basic confession of faith. It wasn't said quite that way, although not far from it in many speeches and sermons. But that was really the break and the founding of the that denomination. So a lot of my scholarship, and I'm trained in sociology of religion, is about trying to make sense both of our nation's kind of divides along race and religious lines, how that influences our politics, but also really of my own upbringing. So what sense does it make? How can I make sense of that white Christian evangelical Southern Baptist world that I grew up in that was highly segregated in Jackson, Mississippi? And in fact, just, you know, one formative influence is that even though Brown v. Board of Education was 1954 that demanded the desegregation of schools, Jackson Public Schools, where I went to school, did not get around to doing that until I was in third grade in 1976. So that was something very central to my own experience. So I think really these books have been about my kind of pulling this thread and just seeing what it uncovers. And so here I am talking to you today.
Yeah. So you mentioned being an elementary student in 1976 when Jackson schools desegregated. That puts you graduating from high school, what, mid-1980s? So you're a really good student. What did you learn about American history, especially, you know, to pick one example you write about in your most recent book, what happened to the Chicago teenager, Emmett Till, just a few miles from where you grew up?
Yeah. Yeah. So like I said, grew up and I was a good student. So that means that, I graduated at the top of my class at the public high school in Jackson, and which means I learned everything the state of Mississippi thought it was fit for me to learn in civics and history classes that were offered at my school. And I'll give two examples. One is you mentioned Emmett Till. The other name that's even closer to my home is Medgar Evers. Now in Mississippi today, there is a Medgar Evers Airport. The Jackson Airport bears his name. But when I was in high school in Mississippi, this was not a name. If you had asked me when I graduated high school at the top of my class, who was Medgar Evers or who was Emmett Till, I would have struggled to give you an answer at all. And Medgar Evers was killed in Jackson, Mississippi, 9 miles from my driveway there. And yet I had never heard his name, didn't know his story. And it's I think, really poignant for Evers because he was the last thing he was doing and the thing that he was gunned down for doing was trying to integrate churches, Baptist and Methodist churches in Jackson. And that was the thing he was gunned down for doing. And he was gunned down, by the way, by an Episcopalian from the Delta. People don't think about that much, but it was a white Christian, someone in member in good standing at an Episcopal church up in Greenwood that came down and killed him with a hunting rifle for trying to integrate society, including churches. And the same for Emmett Till, who was killed up in Tallahatchie County up in the Delta. Not a story I really knew much about at all. It was really had been hidden and submerged as part of who we were.
So what is the turning point for you? How do you start learning about these things? Is it getting out of that place? Is it a change in consciousness in America? What do you attribute that to?
Yeah, well, it's been a long journey now. I graduated high school in 86, graduated college in 90, seminary in 94, and then I did a PhD, finished in 2002, right? And so, this is 20 plus years after that. So it has been a very long journey. And it's been, I think there's no one kind of big, epiphany moment, but small little, what I would describe as small cracks to that edifice. And that edifice is really this lie of white supremacy protecting all of this false history and submerging this other history that would call white supremacy into question or make white Christians or others look bad. And so that it's been that. And honestly, one of the early moments I remember was actually actually at a Southern Baptist seminary. And I had one professor, and this was he was an outlier, really, in telling the truth about this. But it was his name was Leon Macbeth. He was a Baptist history professor, and he was one of the first actually Baptist historians to put it in his own textbook and to say, like, look, the reason for the name Southern in Southern Baptists in our denomination is not just a compass point. It's not, something we're South and they're North, which is the way I'd always been brought up to think about it. But it really was because of this break over the issue of slavery. And that has to be said kind of full stop. And that was quite jarring to me to hear in my early 20s as a seminary student. So I think that was sort of the beginning of it. And then just beginning to kind of get the history, read more about the history, and realize that even as someone with a PhD in religious studies and sociology of religion, that I just barely knew only the surface of things. So these last books have really been my own journey to try to make sense of and to dig deeper and to get to the bottom of it.
What is it about you and the professor you mentioned that makes you open to talking about these issues, studying these issues, when so many people would rather turn away? So many white people in particular.
I don't know. I mean, I think most people want to know the truth. Deep down, I think that's just how human beings are wired. Like, we don't like to be lied to. We don't like to be, fed a fairy tale. We really do want to know the truth and think we can handle the truth. And I think that's kind of part of it for me. My first reactions, honestly, were anger and angry that I had been lied to, that I'd been lied to by my pastors. I'd been lied to by my Sunday school teachers. I'd been lied to by my high school civics and history teachers, and that, you know, it's possible that some of them didn't know better, but I'm guessing that many of them did, and just decided not to tell the truth, and the whole truth. And at the end of the day, you know, for me, it's about integrity. It's about living into a healthier future, and just a deep, deep commitment that we can't build a healthy future together based on lies.
All right, let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is The 21st Show. We're listening back to our conversation with Robert P. Jones, the president and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's also a scholar and author. His most recent book is The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. All right, let's dive into some of the arguments in your book. There have been these attempts to redefine the founding of America away from 1776. Obviously, 1619 is the most famous recent example. You argue for 1493. I appreciate a lot of people talk about 1619 and they say, oh no, that's too woke. We need to go back to 1776. You're like, no, let's go the other direction. So talk about what is it about 1493 that's so crucial to the understanding of America?
Yeah, well, we should all buckle up because this debate is coming back everywhere next year. So next year we will be celebrating the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence and that 1776 birthday. So just as a reminder, you know, what happened was there was this thing that became known as the 1619 Project that Nicole Hannah Jones led, was first published in the New York Times Magazine, and caused this huge uproar. It basically was challenging the way we see the beginning of our story. Instead of thinking about 1776, it was to think about it as 1619. 1619 is the year that a ship arrives in the Virginia, early British colonies, with African Americans who are indentured servants who then become enslaved in Virginia. So it was an argument that if we really want to understand the full story of America, we have to start there. And so in the book, in The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy, I argue what I want to say is kind of a yes and to the 1619 Project. It was viciously attacked by many white scholars in particular and by the Trump administration, who launched its own 1776 Project as the kind of antithesis of 1619. And we're going to see a lot more of that coming. But what I'm arguing is that, look, yes, it is important to dislodge that 1776, to think about an earlier beginning of where our story begins. But that, in fact, if we only stop at 1619, there's a critical piece of that story that we've left off. And that is that might be a good place to start if we really want to understand the first arrival of people of African descent against their will into the British colonies. That's right. But if we want to understand kind of the fuller story, we actually have to keep bringing the lens back even further, kind of widening the aperture, if you will, so that we are a field of vision. Because in 1619, there's already more than a century of European interaction with indigenous people in this country. And again, if we want to understand the full story of where we are, how we got here, we really have to understand that, too. So I argue that we have to take it back at least to 1493. Now, not 1492. That's the year that little nursery rhyme that many may have heard in school. 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, right? But 1493. The reason that date is important, briefly, is because that's the year that Columbus goes back, right? And he's still not exactly sure where he was. He He thinks these are new lands, but he also thinks they may be part of China or the Indies. He's not quite sure. And he goes back, though, and he says, look, I need to the king and queen of Spain. He says, I need more ships. I need more soldiers. I need more supplies. I need to go back. But then the other thing he appeals to, and this is, I think, what's often been missed, is he also asks for something else. He asks for a moral mandate for what he's about to do for the whole colonial project. And he asks for that not from the king and queen of Spain, but from the Christian church. And so at the time in Western Europe, this is the late 15th century. There are no Protestants yet in the world. Everyone in Western Europe is really under the Catholic Church. So he asked the Pope for this permission. And the Pope has already been issuing these things that collectively come known as the Doctrine of Discovery. And they are a set of theological documents, pronouncements from the Pope, the head of the Christian Church in Western Europe, that basically answer the question, what responsibility do European Christians have toward these, quote unquote, newly discovered peoples from a European point of view? And the answer comes back and it's quite blunt. And that is, it is this, that they should be considered, quote, enemies of Christ. That's the language there. And the documents go on to give Columbus and other European explorers the permission to steal their goods, to take their lands, and even in the language of the documents, this is a direct quote, and to submit their persons to perpetual slavery.
Mm.
That's all right there from the head of the Christian Church, late 15th century. And so if we think about what version of Christianity lands on the shores of what we now call the United States of America, it's Christianity with its moral compass set that way.
Okay, we need to take a break on the program. We're going to continue listening back to our conversation with Robbie Jones when we return. We're on tape for the hour today, so no live calls, but plenty of you did have thoughts during our original airing, so we'll be hearing from those who called in soon. You can still let us know what you thought, though, by sending us an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to our conversation with Robert P. Jones, the author of many books on religion in America, including The End of White Christian America, and most recently, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. He's also the president and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, and for the hour, we're talking about the history of white Christian America. Earlier this year, at the National Prayer Breakfast at the U.S. Capitol, President Donald Trump announced the creation of a task force aimed at eliminating anti-Christian bias.
The mission of this task force will be to immediately halt all forms of anti-Christian targeting and discrimination within the federal government, including at the DOJ, which was absolutely terrible, the IRS, the FBI, terrible, and other agencies. In addition, the task force will work to fully prosecute anti-Christian violence and vandalism in our society and to move heaven and earth to defend the rights of Christians and religious believers nationwide.
He made this statement, announced this task force, at a time when Christians overwhelmingly supported his reelection, and there's a rise in Christian nationalism in this country. And that's something the Public Religion Research Institute has documented. I should say, we also asked our texting group about this when we originally broadcast this conversation earlier this year. We heard from Aaron in Anna, who talked about white Christian nationalism, saying, what drives it? Hate. Look at this nation's beginnings. What we did to the natives. You'll be hearing from other callers, again, from that original broadcast, but we're on tape today, so you can let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Robbie, that was exactly the point we were talking about before the break, is how enslavement, whatever immiseration that Columbus and his allies were bringing to the native peoples of the what we now call the Americas, was essentially a gift from God, right? Because it brought them God.
You know, the phrase, that's right. The phrase you see over and over in Christian theology coming out of Europe in these papal decrees is that there is essentially an equation that gets set up. And the equation is basically this, that yes, Europeans are authorized again to take their land, take their goods, take their lives and enslave them. But in exchange for all of that, what Europeans are bringing to them, and the phrase that you hear over and over is Christianity and civilization. Christianity and civilization. And the idea is that that good of bringing them Christianity and civilization outweighs any of the losses that are inflicted upon them. And you just see this argument made straightforwardly all the way through, American history.
Well, let's talk about that, because you point out that the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, everybody knows the contradiction of, you know, all men are created equal being written by the pen of a man who himself was an enslaver. But the document also contains this reference, this was new to me, to merciless Indian savages. So talk about how these ideas inform the founding of our American Constitutional Republic.
Yeah. Well, again, we're going to be celebrating. I hope everyone's going to be rereading the Declaration of Independence over the next, you know, year and a half as we celebrate the 250th anniversary. And there is plenty to celebrate. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the political ideals of equality, all of that is right there. And that is absolutely right. But, you know, if we think about that famous image of kind of all the founders kind of there, you know, gathered around a table, you can kind of picture it in your mind's eye. Probably it was a postage stamp that recorded that as well. And, you know, you look at that image there. It's notable that there was also been an image of that that I saw on social media where somebody had kind of put just a circle around all the faces of the people in that room who signed that document with all these principles in it and yet enslaved other people. And it's a lot of circled heads in that photo. So there's that living contradiction in the people there. But even in the document itself, as you say, if you don't just read the kind of preamble in the beginning principles, but you read on it, we kind of remember that this document was, yes, it was a Declaration of Independence, but it was also a litany of complaints against the King of England. So if you kind of read on down, you do say that there's a couple of things that pop out. One thing is this phrase, merciless Indian savages, is in the Declaration of Independence. And it is a complaint by the British colonists saying that the king has encouraged Native Americans to kind of conduct war on the fringes of the colonies. And they're also upset that the king at the time would not allow them to push further west, that those lands the king considered reserved for the crown and not for the colonists. And they're mad about that. And then the other piece, of course, here is that in the Declaration of Independence, they also complain to the king that the king has encouraged domestic insurrections. And what they mean by that is slave rebellions. And so they're upset about that as well. So inside this document, right, is, yes, these great political principles we're still struggling to live out, and these deep, deep contradictions there around holding on to enslavement and holding on to genocide and displacement of indigenous people, all there in the same document.
So this is such a big question I'm about to ask you. It's almost unfair, and we can break it down maybe into smaller parts if you want. But I want to know, what do you think of how much the founders thought they were creating a white Christian nation, right? I mean, people point to Jefferson had, a copy of the Quran. He wrote his own version of the Bible that sort of took out the miraculous stuff, if you will. You have Thomas Paine arguing for, now that we have freedom from man, we need freedom from religion. Maybe he doesn't put it quite so bluntly, but what do you think the founders thought? What is your best understanding of the degree to which we were a white Christian nation versus a pluralistic nation?
Well, you know, Jefferson's such a contradiction, right? In so many ways, or such a complex, person. He certainly wouldn't have made very many white evangelical Christians today very happy. If you look at his Bible, where he essentially excises all of anything that's about a miracle, anything that is maybe supernatural, all that comes out, right? And it gets reduced really to a kind of Jesus moral teachings kind of approach. That certainly wouldn't be very acceptable to many, people who think of themselves as Orthodox evangelical Christians today. And yet, you know, and he also wrote these beautiful principles of religious liberty and was clearly about that. And so there is that there, right? And that's clearly there in Jefferson's writing in particular. And yet, among many of the other folks, this idea of Christianity and civilization was this kind of overlay of all of it. So it was kind of a cultural commitment or kind of just in the water. But I think that the beautiful thing about these documents and the history is that they kind of lay out these principles that they are just not quite able to live out in their own lives, right? But they hand down to us these principles that I think it's our responsibility to kind of take the baton and live them out more fully as best we can see fit.
And yet we continue to fight about them as we have throughout American history. And that maybe this is a good time to bring in one of our callers at 800-222-9455. On line two, we have Terry calling from Melbourne, Florida. Thanks for listening all the way from Florida, Terry.
Yeah, hi, fellas. I had a couple of questions for you. Apropos of your education in the South, which you said was quite biased and inadequate, were you taught anything about Lincoln's motivations for the Civil War?
That's a great question. You know, I variously heard the Civil War referred to as the war between the states and at times as the war of Northern aggression. So, you know, there was, I think the overall sense of it was that there was this noble cause being fought. Robert E. Lee was very much revered in my home state of Mississippi today. For example, Robert E. Lee's birthday is still celebrated on the same day that Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday is celebrated. And so when the federal holiday for Martin Luther King Jr. was implemented, the state of Mississippi, which was already celebrating Robert E. Lee's birthday, overlaid the two on the same day, essentially giving white people something else to celebrate there. But this sense of the, you know, what came to know as the lost cause was the thing that got celebrated more than anything else. Rebel flags were everywhere. My high school, for example, copied the University of Mississippi, or Ole Miss, right, as it's colloquially known, which is the name for the slave master's wife on a plantation. And our high school, we were the rebels. We flew Confederate flags at the football games. The band played Dixie and we were public school. We were about 40% African American, about 60% white when I was there in the 80s. And yet that was the just like overwhelming tone of things, was that this was a noble cause. And if there was any grand injustice in and around the Civil War, it was not enslaving others that led to the war. It was actually the tragedy of Reconstruction. That is, the kind of Northern scalawags, carpetbaggers coming in and forcing Southerners, white Southerners, to live in a way that was foreign to their own sensibilities.
Terry, you said you had one other question.
Yes, I just want to follow up on that first question for 1 second, and that is that I was having a discussion with a friend of mine who had grown up in South Carolina, and I asserted that Lincoln certainly fought the Civil War to try to eliminate slavery, and his immediate response was, no, 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 it was strictly economic. And I have since heard that in many parts of the South, they certainly would not have taught that Lincoln fought to oppose slavery, but Lincoln fought to gain economic advantage over the Southern states.
Yeah, this was a mythology that was spread, and one that I write about this in White Too Long. One of the most powerful organizations following the Civil War was actually a group of women called the United Daughters of the Confederacy. At their height, kind of at the turn of the 19th, end of the 20th century, they were over 100,000 strong, and they were largely wealthy white women in the South. If you see a monument that's still standing today, and many of them have been thankfully taken down, but if you see a Confederate monument, the chances are very good that it was paid for and put there by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. But the other thing that they had was a textbook campaign. And so there was this kind of public monument campaign. There was also a textbook campaign. And there, it was very much about minimizing the role that slavery played in the war, making it more about economics, making it more about states' rights, obviously. That phrase was the one that, you know, we heard over and over again, that it was a more principled battle over states' rights, not about slavery at all. But, you know, but even Lincoln, the truth is Lincoln evolved on this question. At the beginning of his presidency, he clearly said, you know, if he could save the Union and leave slavery in place, he would do it. But he evolved over time. And some of that was through conversations with Douglas and others over these questions, and later came to see that that it actually was a moral question that was going to ultimately destroy the nation if it didn't get settled.
All right. Thank you, Terry. Really appreciate the call. Thank you so much for that. So let's spin forward to the present moment. Maybe we can go to your sort of other hat at the PRRI and talk about white Christian nationalism. What exactly does that mean, and how popular of an idea is that in America right now?
Great. Sure. So we have at PRRI, we have put out more data, more studies on this phenomenon of white Christian America than any other organization in the country over the past few years. And so I'll tell you, so one of the nice things about defining this when you're doing quantitative social science is that you actually have to have fairly precise definitions. You can't go in with a fuzzy definition. So when we define this in public opinion surveys, and we are asking Americans what they think about these various things, we don't ask them outright, do you consider yourself a Christian nationalist? Or we have asked that, but that's not the measure that we use really to really measure the phenomenon. But what we do ask people is about what they think about Christianity's place in the country, and particularly about its place in a kind of hierarchical understanding of the country. So we ask a series of questions that are things like, U.S. laws should be based on the Christian Bible. To be truly American, one must be Christian. Those kinds of questions that get to, and we ask five of those questions like that, and we use a composite measure of those five questions to measure people's adherence to this idea, essentially that the country is intended to be a Christian nation. And when we do that, what we find is that about 30% of Americans are either white Christian nationalists or Christian nationalist adherents, that is, they believe strongly all five of these questions that we ask, or sympathizers, that is, that they agree but perhaps not fully agree with all those statements. And then about two-thirds of the country are either skeptics or rejectors of that view. So it's about a one-third, two-third break in the country, but it's not even across the country. And one of the reasons why we're hearing about this so much and it's become so prominent in our politics today is because there are two groups among whom a majority agree with these views, or that are either adherents or sympathizers to Christian nationalism, and that is Republicans. 54% of Republicans are either Christian nationalism adherents or sympathizers, and white evangelical Protestants, the group that Trump, when Trump says, my beautiful Christians, he is standing before white evangelical Protestant Christians. He's not standing before African-American Christians when he makes those statements, but he's standing before white evangelicals. And so white evangelicals is three-quarters of that group that are either Christian nationalism adherents or sympathizers.
And maybe I don't know about the Christian nationalist part, but maybe he's standing before Catholics too, which seem to be increasingly shifting conservative in this country. Maybe that's a rabbit hole we don't have time to go down.
Well, but just one caveat on that. Yeah. I mean, even there it's racial and ethnic. So what we see is this big break between white Catholics and Latino Catholics in the country. So there, even there, the white Christian piece is the whiteness that kind of is the glue that pulls Christianity toward Trump and the MAGA movement there. So, for example, if you just want to kind of look at the religious landscape in the country today, and this has been true for 60 years now, that really the way you can look at the landscape is basically this, that really since the civil rights movement, when the Democratic Party became identified as the party of civil rights for African Americans, there was a great white flight of white Christians from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. And so since that happened, essentially every election since Reagan, we have seen, you could describe it this way, that white Christian groups, that's Protestant, Catholic, and others, yeah, vote for Republican candidates, and Christians of color and everybody else vote for Democrats.
All right, we're going to take another break. When we return, the conclusion of our conversation with Robert P. Jones with the Public Religion Research Institute. It was first broadcast earlier this year. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation on Christianity in America with Robert P. Jones. He's the founder of the Public Religion Research Institute and the author of several books, including White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. He says the template for some of our current fights over religious identity and politics goes back to 1493. I should say we also heard from members of our texting group about this idea of Christian nationalism. An anonymous texter said, "As someone who comes from an Anabaptist Mennonite tradition, it's hard for me to fathom Christian nationalism. To conflate patriotism and faith seems like pure idolatry." Kevin and Farina says, "First of all, there's no such thing as Christian nationalism. There's only nationalists who are trying to enlist Christ to their side. Unfortunately, Christ is not up for sale or recruitment. If you actually read the Gospels, Christ is for the common good of all, with an emphasis on those pushed to the sides and bottom. Christ is not about nations, regimes, capitalists. Why do quote-unquote Christians support Trump? Because they've been led astray by false prophets." On the other hand, we heard from Tom in Ilburn, who said, "There are plenty of Christians who support democratic causes. There are also many Christians who are fed up with the leftists and their ESG, DEI, LGBTQ woke agenda. Am I concerned about a rise in white Christian nationalism? Not at all. I'm concerned about the rise of socialism." Thanks to everybody who wrote in back in February when we first aired this conversation. You can join our texting group by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. All right, let's get back to my conversation with Robert Jones. In the time we have remaining, I do want to continue talking about where we are today. And I do want to begin with a soundbite from the year 2015.
You mentioned the Bible. You've been talking about how it's your favorite book. And you said, I think last night in Iowa, some people are surprised that you say that. I'm wondering what one or two of your most favored Bible verses are.
Well,
and why.
I wouldn't want to get into it because to me that's very personal. You know, when I talk about the Bible, it's very personal. So I don't want to get into
verse that means a lot to you that you think about or cite.
The Bible means a lot to me, but I don't want to get into specifics.
Even to cite a verse that you like.
No, I don't want to do that.
You're an Old Testament guy or a New Testament guy?
Probably equal. I think it's just an incredible, the whole Bible is an incredible. I joke very much so. They always hold up the Art of the Deal. I say my second favorite book of all time. But I just think the Bible is just something very special.
Something very special. There were a lot of people who watched that and thought, this is a man who is unable to cite a single Bible verse. Personally, I don't know. I think there are a lot of Americans who still hold on to a belief in God or a God or some sort of higher power and yet are not super religious. I guess this is an entry point into asking about where religious demographics are in America and how President Trump became the avatar for this one potent subgroup of Americans.
Yeah. Well, you know, first, just a comment on that piece, and I'll do the demographics. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty clear. Someone who treats, you know, the Bible as kind of a talisman and has no idea what's on the inside of the covers. So it's like an object, right? I think is what's clear there that he, you know, he didn't want to differentiate between the Old and New Testaments. He didn't dare want to. And when he has been asked about books, you know, he doesn't even know how to pronounce them. He's talked about 2 Corinthians, for example, which anyone who's ever been to church knows that's 2 Corinthians, not 2 Corinthians. So just, you know, not really even inculcated into the culture of what reading the Bible, you know, would mean. You know, and just to kind of segue to the demographics, he's also said he's never seen the need to ask forgiveness for any sins. Now, in pretty much every version of Orthodox Christianity, that is the gateway to being saved or being Christian, is to admit your faults, to ask for forgiveness of sins. He's clearly said that's not something, you know, he has ever felt the need to do.
You know, I'm just going to say, like, from a messaging standpoint, I'm no Bible expert myself. I don't want to pretend to be somebody who can cite chapter and verse. But Matthew 6, right, where the one about don't be a hypocrite praying on the corner. I feel like that answers the question right there. Then you don't have to talk about your private beliefs after that point.
Yeah.
So which the also demographics. Which also has the Lord's Prayer in it. So anyway, go on.
So what is he appealing to here? And I think what he's appealing to, you heard it in the excerpt you began the show with, where he's saying, we're going to bring religion back. We're going to bring the churchgoer back. You just vote one more time, put me in power, right? And you will have power like you have never seen it before, like nobody's ever seen it before in that kind of classic Trump grammar. Like those are the kinds of things he's been selling to white Christians. Now, why would they be willing buyers of that sales pitch? And the reason is that if you look at the demographics in the U.S., and I covered this in The End of White Christian America, we've actually been seeing a lot of shift in terms of the ethno-religious makeup of the country. And so if we use white Christian identity as a marker, you can really see how the country's been shifting really over the last 20 years or so. So if we go back, say, to the beginning, early 2000s, when Barack Obama, our first African-American president, was running for president, the country in 2008, for example, was comfortably majority and Christian. So if you take all Christians together, Protestant, Catholic, non-denominational, who are white and non-Hispanic, the country was 54% white and Christian. 8 years later, when he is coming out of office and Trump is entering the scene, that number has dropped to 47%. So in other words, during the tenure of our first African-American president, the country, you know, coincidentally goes through this sea change and passes a milestone. That is, we go from being a majority white Christian country to a country that's no longer a majority white Christian country. And if you look at evangelicals, the ones who are the most tied, white evangelical Protestants, the ones who are most tied to Trump, they have actually experienced the biggest drops in membership over that period of time. They went from being nearly a quarter of the country in the early 2000s down to today. They're only 13%, 13% of the country today. So this is a group that has seen itself shrinking. It's aging. Its median age has gone up as it's gotten smaller, which tells you it's losing young people. They see their children and grandchildren not coming to church. And so Trump is appealing to a group that has seen itself as the rightful inheritors of the American dream and being on the top of the power pyramid in the country, and yet experiencing themselves in decline. And that's why they've been willing buyers of this message, regardless of Trump's religiosity. I think they've long given up on making Trump Christian, but they are now sort of thinking of him as the protector of white Christianity in the country.
How receptive do you find people are to talking about white Christianity and the roots of white supremacy and the things you cover in your books? I mean, you know, 5 years ago with the George Floyd, you know, following his murder, people were more open to these conversations. How have you seen that change in your work?
They have been. And I will say, like, in my lifetime, you know, it's been the most open. And I was born in 1968. You know, it's been the most open I've seen white congregations to kind of wrestling with their own history, to our obvious place in suppressing the rights of others and doing it in the name of God, and trying to take that seriously and trying to make amends for that. I mean, we've seen lots of movement around that, even denunciations of the doctrine of discovery, this kind of early, you know, 15th century Christian doctrine that was made by a number of the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians. Pope Francis himself sort of apologized, you know, for the Catholic Church's role in that as well. I'm still seeing that happening. I mean, I just came this weekend from a Presbyterian church in New Jersey, where they invited me in to come have this conversation with them. And the predominantly white, 300-year-old, predominantly white Scottish Presbyterian church, and realizing that they had played a role in occupying indigenous land and in enslaving and enslaving others and supporting that with their own theology. And so trying to make, and then, so what do we do? How do we tell the truth? And how do we make amends for that? So I think these conversations are still going on. I do think they're going to get harder with the new Trump administration. And this anti-Christian bias thing, I just will mention very quickly, isn't what it sounds like, right? Hate crimes in America, only 10% of religiously biased hate crimes had anything to do with Christians in the country, more than half of them had to do with Jews. They were anti-Semitic. And more than double the rate of whites had to do with hate crimes against Muslims and Buddhists and people of other religious faiths. So it's not even really a major problem that we have in the country, but it's a way of saying that there's a preference for Christians in the country. And if you really pay attention to who Trump is talking about, he's not talking about protecting the rights of African-American Christians in the country. He's really talking about protecting the rights of white Christians and particularly white evangelical Christians who agree with him.
So as we are winding down our time together, how do you, I'm sure you've been called woke and all the other things that, that people can be called, probably a lot worse that we maybe don't want to repeat on the radio. you know, how do you respond to that? How do you deal with that? How do you try to find an entry point to talking about these things with people?
Yeah, I mean, mostly I try to tell my own story. I mean, you know, I'm a guy who, again, I mean, I was, you know, baptized at age six in my Southern Baptist church and grew up very much inside that world. I have a seminary degree. I took it all very, very seriously. Spent my whole life studying it. You know, I had a Confederate flag on my pickup truck in high school. I mean, that's who I was. But again, it's a story of wanting to be able to tell the truth and wanting to live a better life in relationship with my black and brown brothers and sisters, and one that wasn't based on a lie of dominance and white supremacy. So I think I start by sort of telling a story that's not about shame. It's a story about growth. It's a story about healing. It's a story about solidarity and brotherhood. And by the way, all of that, I would say, is pretty representative of what most Christians at least used to talk about as discipleship, but now dismiss as woke.
You had a book back in, I think it was 2008, Progressive and Religious, How Christian, Jewish, yeah. Muslim, and Buddhist Leaders Are Moving Beyond the Culture Wars and Transforming American Life. I don't want to say you jinxed us, but how do you think about that now?
Well, you know, we're clearly, I think the best way to think about what's happening now is just this extreme backlash moment that we're experiencing. I mean, you can just see in the, you know, whenever you see this much chaos, it is a mark of desperation. And that desperation is because there was real traction for the, you know, again, for the first time in my lifetime, I saw white Christian churches being willing to put the words white supremacy on the marquee out in front of their church and saying, we're going to have an honest conversation about this and our role in this and what we can do to repair the damage. And that was happening and is happening across the country. And this is kind of this like authoritarian backlash against that movement toward justice and equality and all that. So, you know, I haven't given up on, you know, the winds that were kind of moving us that direction, even if we're seeing kind of this hard, hard pushback on it from the Trump administration today. This has really contributed to what I'm calling America's identity crisis. And just it just boils down to this one question, you know, about who we are as a country. Are we a pluralistic democracy where everyone stands on equal footing before the law? Or are we also an old American tradition? Are we a nation that was divinely ordained by, you know, ordained by God to be a promised land for white Christians? These two things are mutually exclusive claims. And I think we're at a part where that question is being called and once again to answer clearly which of these paths we're going to take. And before we go, I'd love to invite everyone to, I have a weekly newsletter that's at www.whitetoolong.net where I write weekly and people can follow me there.
Robert P. Jones, if you're searching him on Amazon, but if you get to meet him in person, he's okay with Robbie. Robbie Jones, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
On the 21st Show. Again, Robert Jones's books include The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and The Path to a Shared American Future, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, and The End of White Christian America. He's also the president and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. And that's all the time we have for today. Coming up tomorrow, we're planning to spend the entire program in Danville, Illinois. First, talking about a phenomenon that a lot of small and mid-sized cities have experienced, and that is young adults moving out and not coming back. There are a variety of reasons behind this: lack of jobs, a need to branch out. We'll talk about how Danville's been affected and what drives some to stay and others to go. Also, weather permitting, we'll cover the Balloons Over Vermilion, the hot air balloon festival that occurs in the area every year. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan, and Leili Nazarova is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.